Members, if you would take your seats, we are going to go ahead and start because this is a bill we had before us yesterday, and we had one more witness to hear today. We had not had an opportunity to hear from the department, and so we're going to take a couple of minutes today to hear that piece of Representative Ladd's bill, and that will be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome. I'm sure you just walked in. You're probably out of breath.
No, I'm okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good. Go ahead, Ms. Roberts. Introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members, Amy Roberts with the Department of Education. I understand that the fiscal note that we are preparing for this bill is made it through our agency, but apparently it had a couple of stops at some other agencies on the way, and so I'm not positive if it has made it over here at this point in time or not. So I apologize that I don't believe it's actually ready and in packets at this
point. It's apparently not ready yet, or we would have received it.
Okay.
So just go ahead and give us, I guess, you know, something of your insights on this bill, since I think this was an issue that kind of probably hit you by surprise the other day.
Madam Chair, members, a little bit it did. The maltreatment program began in about 1999 as sort of a surprise. Well, I don't know if it was a surprise, but it was the idea being that we were looking to have some independent investigative oversight in schools for maltreatment situations, but there was no way of estimating exactly the number of cases that we would be looking at or that the department would be faced with. And I believe at the time, the agency thought it was going to be able to absorb whatever type of caseload came in the door. They were anticipating maybe 50 cases. That has turned out to not be the case. And the department right now averages about 600 intakes per year. Not all of those intakes results in a full investigation. We have the intakes. We do the initial evaluation of whether or not there's jurisdiction or whether it meets the statutory definitions of maltreatment. And then we proceed with an investigation in about a third of those cases, a third to a half, depending on, and that fluctuates by year. So at the present time, we have three full-time investigators who cover statewide with our current jurisdiction. And to be honest, the three investigators, that's their current caseload is pretty much the maximum caseload that I'm comfortable with them having or carrying at this point in time to actually do a thorough investigation. And by thorough, I mean that can be dependent on reports we receive from law enforcement or just information that we're able to obtain from districts. It does not always include an on-site visit by our investigators. In many cases, it will. It depends on the particular case involved. Some of them are more complicated. Some of them are very straightforward. So it very much varies depending on what type of fact situation is presented. This particular legislation is proposing to expand our jurisdiction pretty significantly. Our initial evaluation that you'll see spelled out a little bit more thoroughly in the fiscal note when it finally reaches you, we anticipate that this is probably going to more than double our caseload at this particular time. We are having a hard time predicting with any type of accuracy what type of numbers we're looking at because the particular programs involved here, in the cases where the department actually has numbers, we have numbers by district. So, for example, the Head Start program, we have 341 districts, but within a given district, there could be more than one particular Head Start site. We don't have accurate numbers on just how many sites are in existence within those particular districts. So it's very difficult to ascertain just how many particular locations we're going to be looking at. So we are basically using the district number and understanding that that may or may not give us a really good head count of what we're looking at. So based on our current population of what we're currently looking at, we kind of came up with a formula of, given our population of whatever the number is, which I have somewhere in my paperwork, we probably would see a case in about 30% of the jurisdictions that we're looking at right now. So what we did was take the number of what we anticipate our new sites to be and basically came up with 30% of that is what our new caseload is going to look like. And from that, we anticipate that it will increase our caseloads by about 60%. So the request from our fiscal note is going to be to basically double the staff and then an additional staff to handle the intakes that will increase because of this. Because we're concerned that while the language in the bill is better than how it started, we still anticipate we're going to have some jurisdictional questions and we'll need to do an initial evaluation of whether or not the particular location of the program still falls within MDE jurisdiction or not. As I understand, I can pause if you...
No, actually, Ms. Roberts, I was wondering about Head Start, for example. The 0-3 Head Start is more like a child care program, and that's already investigated by counties. So would Head Start fall under your jurisdiction? Because it's often not located in a school. It's in a separate building someplace. So I was kind of curious about how this would work out in the long term.
Madam Chair and members, that is a question we've been trying to figure out ourselves. Admittedly, our program right now, the Student Male Treatment Program, does not have any jurisdiction or interaction with some of these early learning service programs or the early childhood programs. So our background isn't particularly strong in these areas, and we're just starting now to have some conversations with other people in the department about how these programs work and where they're located and what we would anticipate seeing. And we are learning or finding or discovering that it's not going to be very clear-cut in many instances whether it's an MDE jurisdiction or if it's a local service jurisdiction, which is why we're anticipating whoever's working on intake, there's going to be we're going to have to develop some type of initial questionnaire to determine,
okay,
is this an MDE situation or will it be a local county jurisdictional question?
All right. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Are there any questions for Ms. Roberts quickly? Hearing none. We will just lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Latz, did you have final words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your question was very perceptive, and I will note that this added jurisdiction for the department is only in connection with programs located in the school buildings. And there is a catch-all provision that would defer any other jurisdictions to local county welfare agencies. And my final thought is that if, in fact, there would be such a significant caseload increase, I query where any of these complaints or allegations are being investigated now. If they are not, it points to the need, yep, to have someone available to do this kind of an investigation if there's no one providing any independent oversight at this time. So it would behoove us, I think, behoove you to try to find some resources to enable these kind of investigations to actually occur, or there's a lot of abuse going on out there, or allegations of abuse that simply are falling through the cracks, and that's not right either.
It seems to me that, Representative Last, that some of this wouldn't normally fall into the hands of education, that there's child protection out there, the court services out there, social services, and all of a sudden, you know, it's kind of throwing the education department into an area where it hasn't been dealing with before, to a certain extent. But, you know, that discussion is not for today. We don't have any more time to spend on this. Thank you for your patience in coming back a third time.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
All right, we are going to move along. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, and we are going to move along to the next bill, Representative Biskins, House File 3908.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 3908 before the committee.
Thank you, Representative. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill deals with an interdisciplinary teaching license. It directs the Board of Teaching to, through rulemaking, adopt the rules providing for an interdisciplinary teaching license. It creates a process whereby a post-secondary teacher preparation program can apply for, can develop and apply for the right to develop curriculum necessary for this program. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill was given extensive hearing in the Education Policy and Reform Committee, where it passed out on an overwhelming voice vote. Madam Chair, members, there is no fiscal note, formal fiscal note in your packet, but I have been informed by fiscal staff that the fiscal note to this bill would be approximately $210,000, and that would account for the rulemaking that the Board of Teaching would have to accomplish. Madam Chair, this bill is supported by MACS, the Minnesota Association of Chartered Schools, and also strongly supported by Minnesota Rural Education Association, MREA, and I'll stand for questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Biskins? I know some of us heard this bill for quite a long time in the Policy Committee, so we're pretty familiar with it. But I'd be happy to entertain questions if some of you have questions. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. I was not in policy, so I don't know. Define for me, if you would, Representative Biskins, the interdisciplinary teaching and learning program model. Specifically, what are you talking about?
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Newman, without getting into too much specificity, and that's why I believe that Minnesota does create a process called rulemaking to flesh that out. In the more general, it is the ability to work with students who are working on a project-based curriculum. We've had a lot of discussion and a lot of, learnings in the past few years about how educationally teaching subjects in the egg carton model, where you do math here and science here and social studies here, may not be the best way to acquire knowledge and skills. Sometimes it's better to look at the whole curriculum, the development of projects, the development of making the connections between the learnings and how all of that interplays may indeed be a better model for teaching students and for students learning and acquiring new knowledge and skills. And so that is the model that we are looking at as we look at different kinds of reforms. To have a licensed teacher who's working with students who may be working in a project that incorporates a number of different subjects. Right now we have no ability to do that, and so we're looking for the development of that type of teaching license.
Representative Newman, did you have a follow-up?
No.
All right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Representative Newman.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to piggyback on Representative Bissett's answer to you. It's probably a licensure that will have its greatest strength in different teaching strategies because of the crossing over of disciplines. And I think that's probably why the rulemaking is going to be more expensive, because the Board of Teaching staff will have to spend a great deal of time trying to integrate content with teaching strategies.
Representative Biskins, are there further questions for Representative Biskins? Hearing none, Representative Biskins. Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Alzwager, wherever you are, did you have 2 minutes. Since I think you testified in the other committee also, right?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alzwager, Education Minnesota, you're absolutely right, I did. And there are some different members, so I think it's valuable to take the 2 minutes to talk about it a little bit. I just want to make it very clear that Education Minnesota does not support this bill, and we actually would encourage you to oppose the bill. And let me make it clear as to why. When you're talking about interdisciplinary teaching, and you know, Representative Biskins is right, that is, you know, a valuable model, valuable method of teaching. But what this does is creates a license that has nothing to do with a content area. It has to do with a method of teaching. If you talk to individuals who are knowledgeable about content area and teaching licensing, they will tell you that to teach an interdisciplinary unit, it is a higher level of teaching skill, and you really need to know your content area. And what you're asking, what you would be allowing here, is the ability for someone who is licensed in math to teach science when they don't have the skills to do that. And I just want to highlight something I heard today on the radio, and I'm going to have to look this up and get more information about it. Did you know that some studies have been done related to science test scores around the world that say the reason that some countries perform better than others is because the way they teach? And you need the content and you need the pedagogy. And this does not provide for the content licensure. We would recommend that if project-based learning is a desire, that you have people licensed in each of the content areas, and then you would have a superb interdisciplinary unit. This is going in the wrong direction, and we would encourage you to oppose this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there a question for Ms. Alzwager? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. I just have a comment. Governor Pawlenty said last Friday in his remarks at the Science Museum that Minnesota used to be a leader in innovation. I think this is a way in which we can become, again, a leader in innovation. Yes, this is going to be a new and different kind of teaching license, but I have faith that the staff at the Board of Teaching will figure out how to blend content and pedagogy, and I think I look forward to the debates they're going to have.
Representative Griden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since I'm not in Ways and Means, I'm going to make just a comment on that comment that I wanted to give in Ways and Means, but we had to be down here too. I'm supporting this bill, and you know, I think it's a practical bill that for the reasons that MRE has asked for it, but I think it's a compromise that we are doing because of practicality. I don't think it's any great innovation of any sort. And if the governor is, you know, he gave a talk at the Science Museum last week, but he asked for the reform and innovation that he did have in his proposal, $26-something million, and now I know, you know, everyone in this committee is very distressed to hear that we have less than a quarter of that to spend. I worry that we're not going to be doing a lot of the governor's innovations that he was talking about at the Science Museum last week.
All right. Seeing no other questions, Representative Biskins, your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you
members.
Very much. I think Representative Demmer, would you like to fill in over here? Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House File 4040 before the committee. This is to get an update on... Oops, I brought the wrong one. Oh, no. No, I'm sorry. For a minute, I thought I had a different bill. Sorry about that. This is to give you an update on some of what I think the wonderful work that Audrey Sucker and the folks that work with her have been doing. A few years ago, we started, are you in your fourth year, third year? They're in their third year. So 4 years ago when we started this, the idea was to work with Head Start and try to get a little more academics into that curriculum that Head Start uses, so there would be a little bit more early childhood preparation for school type stuff in that curriculum. And this group has been doing, I think, quite an excellent job. And what the bill is asking for is $250,000. And I will just let Ms. Suker or any of the other people you've brought,
yes.
Why don't you grab chairs from over there or something so that you can sit down. I'll get out of your way. You can introduce everybody as they come up. I'll get out of the way.
Welcome to committee, Ms. Suker.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, I am Audrey Suker, and I serve as Executive Director of Serve Minnesota. We are responsible for administering the AmeriCorps program in the state. You have in front of you a group that is assembling that is passionate about the power of AmeriCorps to help Minnesota solve problems. And today we are here to talk about how a $250,000 increase in Serve Minnesota's state appropriation would leverage additional AmeriCorps resources to ensure that more children start kindergarten on target to become readers by third grade, and at the other end of the spectrum, to ensure that more low-income students are admitted to college. Please know that we will limit our remarks to not exceed 15 minutes, only calling your attention to the most important components of our work, and we will begin with focusing on our early literacy initiative, which falls under a large umbrella that we call the Minnesota Reading Corps. And we know that nothing is more important for you to hear than evidence that these programs work. So this is how our testimony will unfold. First, you will hear from Dr. David Heisted, who will present research findings on the Minnesota Reading Corps model. Dr. Heisted will be followed by Dr. Christina Sharon, who will describe the key strategies that make our model work. After Dr. Sharon, you will hear from Candy Mellon, who will describe the impact of the model on a Head Start agency. Then we will conclude the early literacy testimony with letting you hear from Christy Baldacci, an AmeriCorps member that is part of the program. And you need to know that AmeriCorps members are the heart and soul of this work, and it's only because individuals like Christy are willing to give a year or two of their lives in service to their communities that a program like this is possible. After Christy speaks, we will be finished with testimony on the early literacy part of this bill, and then we'll shift to Jim McCorkle, Executive Director of Admission Possible, who will speak to the value of increased resources to help ensure low-income students are admitted to college. So let's begin. Dr. Heisted.
Okay, Dr. Heisted, if you'd introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chairperson Demmer and members. My name is David Heisted. I'm the Executive Director of Research Evaluation Assessment for Minneapolis Public Schools. And I've served as the data analyst for this program for the last 2 years. We'll briefly summarize the outcomes, and if they are located in the PowerPoint that is the black and white PowerPoint, hopefully in front of you. Also, you'll see it on the overhead screens. We start with information on the progress for preschool students who are in Head Start on some basic skills that have been shown to be very strong predictors of reading well by first grade. This particular slide shows the growth within a year from students that were in AmeriCorps classrooms. In the areas of rhyming, picture naming, alliteration, which is the beginning sound of a word, letter sounds, and letter names. And these key skills, if they're obtained by the beginning of kindergarten, really increase the probability of students reading well by the end of first grade and then doing well on the third grade Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. You can see that there are large increases here in the percentage of students who reach an ambitious target. The targets for each of these assessments were set with Minneapolis Public Schools and St. Croix River Educational District spread. And we found the stretch goal where if students could rhyme at least 10 rhyming situations, they would be on track for passing the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment in third grade. Likewise, the picture naming, the alliteration, etc. Then we move to a slide that indicates how the skills are for these students once they arrive, in this case in Minneapolis, where we did a match sample analysis. Here are the demographics of the students that were in the AmeriCorps classrooms for Head Start, the PICA program in Minneapolis. So you can see that 60% of the students were English language learners, 92% of the students were students in poverty,
and a large percentage were students of color. Only 4% of the students in this sample were white American students. And what I did was I found a matched sample for every student that was in an AmeriCorps class. I found a Head Start student that was not in the AmeriCorps class. And then I also found students that weren't in Head Start at all. When they arrived in kindergarten in Minneapolis schools and found out what their beginning literacy skills were like. And this is a fairly strong evaluation design, one that the federal government wants to see more of, where you actually have matched samples of individual students. What we found is that 53% of the AmeriCorps students, when they showed up in kindergarten, were on track for reading well. 42% of the matched sample of PICA students, the Head Start students, were on track, and that only 37% of non-Head Start students. And so what we're finding, and this has been true over 2 years of evaluation, is that the Head Start students are doing better than non-Head Start students, and that the students that were in AmeriCorps classrooms that got the additional tutoring are doing even better. So it's a real positive outcome. In both the data from SCRED and from Minneapolis, we found that the scores have increased last year versus this current school year. And so all of the evaluation data look positive that we're seeing significant results for the AmeriCorps volunteers' efforts in the Head Start classrooms. And I did a statistical test, and with 99% certainty, the AmeriCorps program is doing better than non-AmeriCorps control groups. And that in general, PICA, the Head Start program in Minneapolis, students are doing better than students that aren't in the PICA program who are matched by demographics. So very positive outcomes. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, we'll talk more about the program itself.
Any questions from members? Okay, now would you be Dr. Sharon?
Yes, I am. I'm Christina Sharon.
Welcome.
Thank you for having us today. The Minnesota Reading Corps is now working in 13 Head Start sites and 25 classrooms, with projected growth next year of 25 sites and 49 classrooms. We can be found both in urban and in greater Minnesota. Many messages start off with that phrase, "I have good news and I have bad news for you." This message is good. Our model works, and today I'd like to show you why our model works, why I think the model works. Our pre-kindergarten children are acquiring early literacy skills that they need to succeed in kindergarten and beyond, and they acquire these skills more rapidly than children in other pre-K programs, as Dr. Heistad has just demonstrated. The program has four main components. The first is that we have defined kindergarten literacy readiness based on research that comes out of the University of Minnesota, the University of Oregon. It's this research that also informs the assessment measures that we use. And these assessment measures are reliable, they're accurate, and we can use them over and over again. But we don't stop there. We take those assessment measures and then we tailor individual instruction to individual children or small groups of children in a preschool classroom. And we have the ability to do that because of the AmeriCorps members. Finally, this excellent model builds capacity at each site, so that when we leave, and how do we build capacity? We train, we coach, we mentor. We don't do one workshop and then walk away. We spend time with each of those sites and the people in those sites. They're all on the same plane. They're all hearing the same message. Once we leave those programs, we have trained, skilled staff and children ready for kindergarten. The model works particularly well with the AmeriCorps members and the Serve Minnesota organization. Let me describe basically or briefly how the model works and why it works so well. AmeriCorps members, together with teachers, educational supervisors, receive extensive training in research-based early literacy skill development. Following that, they receive this ongoing coaching so that they can refine their skills. The training and coaching is crucial to the success of this program. This is not your ordinary one-time workshop. That would be a waste of time, considering most of us lose everything we learn within about 24 hours. If we don't practice it, some of us lose it faster, the older we get. This is a 7-day training session spread over several weeks, followed up with a year-long coaching and mentoring process. The training prepares the members, the AmeriCorps members, the teachers, in these early literacy skills: rhyming, letter naming, sounds, vocabulary, and other important early literacy components. They take that information and they create instruction that comes from the assessment measures that they also are trained to deliver to these children. The value of having data that informs instruction is not a new idea, but a really important idea, and I think it addresses why this program works so well. One of the key things I want to talk about is how that assessment is continuous, so that once individual education plans are developed for these children, we know what their needs are, then we continue to monitor progress. When children are making progress, we go forward. When children are not making progress, we reevaluate what we're doing and we reassess. So it's that continuous progress and that cycle that you can't see very well here that allows us to know at any given moment, where are these children? Are they progressing? If not, what do we need to do? The key point I want to make is this program works because of the committed AmeriCorps members who work alongside our classroom teachers, enabling them to do more. They're trained to collect benchmark data that's essential to tailoring these instructional programs. They're also trained to implement literacy-rich activities. And they all approach this task with great commitment and valuable experience for the programs and the children in them. And in the end, children learn. And that's the whole point.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we have, are you Ms. Valdaki?
Candy Malin.
Oh, okay. Welcome, Ms. Malin.
Thank you. Chairperson Demmer, members of the committee, my name is Candy Malin, and I'm the Director of Education for Parents and Community Action, the designated federal Head Start grantee in Hennepin County, a nonprofit agency servicing 2,300 families. And I'm here to tell you three ways Minnesota Reading Corps has impacted our program. Number one, how Minnesota Reading Corps impacts PICA's teachers, parents, both monetarily and educationally. Number two, how the Minnesota Reading Corps coaching is instrumental in the success of the program. And number three, how Minnesota Reading Corps impacts our program's child outcomes. Since the beginning of our partnership with Minnesota Reading Corps 3 years ago, we have seen many positive gains. The first positive gain came from deciding to recruit our own parents and teachers to participate in AmeriCorps. Parents and teachers both receive a federal AmeriCorps scholarship of up to $4,700. In addition to this, PICA parents receive a modest living stipend of up to $10,000 for their year of service. The education grant has allowed PICA parents an opportunity like no other to go to college without the burden of loans. We have had a total of 26 AmeriCorps members participate over the last 3 years. This has resulted in positive gains for 646 children in PICA Head Start centers all over Hennepin County. The intense training and coaching described by Christina was the next positive gain for us. In addition to the AmeriCorps members being trained, I was trained to be an internal literacy coach. In that role, I met with each member a minimum of 30 minutes every other week to give feedback, set goals, and help plan activities for the children. Coaching also included completing observations of the AmeriCorps members while they were teaching, assessing the classroom environment for literacy-rich materials, and reviewing outcome data with the member to plan and guide instruction for children. The coaching component is the backbone of the Minnesota Reading Corps model and has been central in our efforts to help our children make the strong literacy, early literacy progress you are hearing about today. Finally, at PICA, Minnesota Reading Corps has added to our success that has already been established from over 30 years of providing outstanding programming to our families and children. And with PICA's curriculum, the New World curriculum, and partnerships like the Minnesota Reading Corps, we have shown to be even more successful, and children have higher scores on local and national assessments like the Beginning Kindergarten Assessment and the Head Start National Reporting System. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mellon. Next we have, now we have Ms. Valbacchia, Ben.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Chairperson Demmer, members of the committee, my name is Christy Valbacchia, and although I'm a licensed teacher to teach grades preschool through sixth grade, I chose to first serve a year in AmeriCorps before starting my teaching career. And as an AmeriCorps Minnesota Reading Corps member, I spend my time working with the children in the Anoka Washington Head Start program. It has been a joy getting to know these children throughout the year. A class consisting of 17 preschool-age children is a lot of work, so teachers are often spread so thin that they just do not have time for some of the things that I am able to do as an AmeriCorps member. For example, in the beginning of the day, both teachers are busy filling in the attendance, counting the kids, and talking to the parents. Meanwhile, 17 children are anxiously buzzing around their classroom waiting for their day of school to begin. As an AmeriCorps member who does not have the full responsibilities of the classroom teachers, I am able to help guide the children in beginning their daily routine, starting with writing their names. It has been very rewarding to see how much the children have grown throughout the year. One girl, who can now recognize 24 letters in 1 minute, almost the entire alphabet, started off the year only being able to recognize about 8 letters per minute. I honestly believe that the individualized instruction that a Minnesota Reading Corps member can provide has played a huge part in building these early literacy skills. As a person working daily on the ground level, I am here to tell you that this program works. This program gives these children the foundation they need for future success in school. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Valbacchia. Next we have Mr. McCorkle. Any questions from members at this point? Okay. Mr. McCorkle, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim McCorkle, and I'm the founder and executive director of an organization called Admission Possible. And I brought along an AmeriCorps member who serves with our organization, so if time allows, you could feel free to ask her some questions. You should have in your packet a one-page description of our program. It's got a green gate at the top. And I just thought I would give a very brief description of our program, describe some of our results, and if time allows, I'd be happy to answer questions. Our organization is designed to help low-income students prepare for and earn admission to college. So we do a number of activities with students during their junior and senior years, which are outlined in the first paragraph there. We have grown over the last 5.5 years from a pilot program serving about 35 kids to now about 600 kids. We have a plan now to expand over the next 3 years to serving 1,300 students. We have been able to achieve some outstanding results. We recently completed an external evaluation that was conducted by the Wilder Foundation that confirms the results I'm about to report. The first is that of all the students who have come through our program, 97% have earned admission to college. As a reference point, most low-income students don't apply to college at all, let alone earn admission. It's hard to know exactly what percent of our kids would have earned admission to college in the absence of our services, but we estimate it to be no more than about 33% of the students that we work with might have earned admission without our services. So we really move the needle a lot on admissions. We're also proud to report that once our students earn admission to college, they're able to stay there and achieve success. 88% of the students who have come through our program and enrolled in college are still in college working toward their degree, and our oldest group of students are now college seniors, so we'll begin to have graduation data shortly. This fall, we were pleased to receive the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits Mission Award for Innovation. We've been recognized in a number of national by a number of national media sources, as well as some local sources as well. The funding that this legislation would provide to Admission Possible, we would be able to match dollar for dollar with private sector funding. Combined, it would allow us to add about 70 more students to our program. Finally, the last thing I thought I would say, and then I'd turn it over to the committee for questions if there's time. A prominent business leader in Minneapolis, a guy named Peter Kiegaard, has done a social return on investment analysis of our program, trying to measure what is the social benefit of providing these services. And he found that the social return on investment is about 500% over a student's lifetime. And that comes primarily from the fact that a student who goes to college will earn more money, which is really a private benefit for them, but they'll pay a lot more in taxes over their lifetime. And, of course, they're much less likely to be incarcerated or to need other costly social services. So we believe that an investment in our organization is a good investment in the future of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McCorkle. Any questions from members? I do have one, and this gets into a little bit more minutia, and we are short on time, but the things that came to my mind is you mentioned identify low-income young people. How do you identify them? What's low-income, and how do you incorporate in with school counselors, for example?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we work right now in partnership with 9 high schools in the Twin Cities, 4 in Minneapolis, 5 in St. Paul. We'll be expanding that over the coming years, and we hope to get to greater Minnesota as well. We work closely with school staff, and we engage in about a 6-week process where we inform students about our existence and invite them to come to information sessions, and then they go through an application process to join the program. The primary criteria is that they're low income, but they do also need to have a 2.5 GPA, and they need to have passed their 8th grade basic standards test.
Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you were going to do it anyway, but I just wanted to make sure we're going to hear from the last testifier.
Oh, did you want to testify?
I can answer any questions, but Jim has basically said all I was.
Representative Garland, I think when she came up, he mentioned that she probably wouldn't testify, but was there for questions.
All right,
if you could introduce yourself, at least for the record, so we know who you are.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vidisha Bhattacharya, and I've served with Mission Possible as an AmeriCorps member for the past year and a half. So I work at Roosevelt High School with 34 high school seniors, and all of whom have been admitted to college, so it's very exciting.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'll just ask my question for you then. What would you say is the most effective thing that you do with those students to get them to want to go to college or to be able to?
Well, when the students enter the program, they are already wanting to go. That's why they joined. I think the most effective thing we do is tell them what their choices are. Most students come into the program maybe knowing about MCTC, maybe knowing about the U of M, but there are so many other educational choices out there that these students have and they just don't know about. So I think that's one of the main things we do. The other thing is we give them an intensive ACT prep. We are trained by Kaplan to give them 15 weeks of ACT preparation, which last year I think we had an overall score increase of about 18%. My students increased their scores by an average of 23%. I had score increases go from like an 11 to a 19. So we not only allow them to know their choices, but we are able to give them the opportunity to increase their scores so they can actually access some of those options later.
Okay, one more question, Representative Erickson, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Chair Dimmer. Vidisha, would you explain to us whether or not you track the academic success of these students then as they enter the program, stay in the program, and then continue?
Yes. While they're in the program, we as coaches not only help them in their after-school college prep, but we are also very involved in their academics. I had a student recently come up to me. He's not doing very well in his classes, but I sat down with him. We're going to meet with all his teachers. So we very much are involved in their academic life. We also have people specifically assigned to track the alumni of the program, and they make sure that they're having access to the resources on their campuses. They meet with them during the year to make sure that they know who each other are, all the alums at the different campuses, and also that they know the resources. There's resource fairs, things like that. So they do definitely track both within high school and after.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Sikora, final word?
Yes, not quite final, but almost final. I just neglected to mention early because I knew we were in a hurry and I was trying to rush through this, but this $250,000 does leverage quite a bit of other help as well, and I just thought if Ms. Sucre could just very quickly mention that.
Yes, I would like to mention that. The $200,000 state investment increase on the literacy investment, we would match with $200,000 in private, and then that $400,000 would leverage $1.6 million in federal resources. And Mr. McCorkle has already talked about the leveraging power for Admission Possible, basically doubling the size of their federal ward.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything else?
Nope. I think it's a great program. I just wanted you all to hear about it. Thank you.
Okay. It's okay, Representative Sikora. Madam Chair, we can take it out of Representative Magnus's time. Thank you. We'll House File 4040 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Magnus. Members, we're going to go out of order just a bit. Representative Magnus here with his testifier. I don't think this will take too long, and then we can let him get on to other things. The rest of the bills are all for members here in the committee. So. Representative Magnus, welcome to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you taking time to have us explain House File 3861.
Representative Magnus, I should mention also, members, this is a bill that will be for information only. This will not be part of our bill. So, proceed.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we did meet the Department of Revenue, Department of Finance, the Department of Natural Resources, and I met with your staff, Greg and Karen, last week and went over this bill, and I appreciate you having us, giving us a chance to talk to you about it this morning. It's an effort to get more land enrolled in the Prairie Native Prairie Program, and with me this morning I have Mr. Steve Hirsch from the Department of Natural Resources to explain the bill a little bit. You do have a handout that I hope is in your packets and the materials that we'll speak from the majority of our time.
Mr. Hirsch.
One of the pictures on it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, Steve Hirsch, Department of Natural Resources, Ecological Services, and I also appreciate the opportunity to come here today to talk about our Native Prairie tax bill. The overall goal of the bill is to provide additional incentives for landowners to maintain Minnesota's remaining Native Prairie, and what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about what Native Prairie is, why it's important, and just explain the bill. It shouldn't take too long. In a nutshell, Native Prairie is grassland in Minnesota that's never been plowed and has characteristic Native Prairie vegetation. And it's arguably the most threatened ecosystem in Minnesota. We originally had about 19 million acres in the state. We're now down to about 150,000 acres, or less than 1%. And about 100,000 of those acres are in private ownership. It's also, because it's been reduced so much, it's also home to about 40% of the state's endangered and threatened species. And it's also important for providing hunting land and has agricultural functions, too, with regard to haying and grazing. There are two distinct parts to the bill, and I think it helps in our understanding to just explain them separately. And so I'll go in the order that they're in the bill. In Section 1 of the bill has to do with providing additional incentives for enrollment into the Prairie Tax Exemption Program. And this is a program that was created in 1980, and it provides a property tax exemption for qualifying tracts of Native Prairie. And to qualify, the land must be dominated by Native Prairie vegetation. When the language was first put into law, or when it was put into law, grazed land was excluded from the program, and at that time that made sense based on what we knew about grazing. But we've since learned that, and it's true that intensive grazing that's done in a way that isn't friendly to Native Prairie habitat can diminish the quality of the Native Prairie. However, there are ways to incorporate best management practices into the grazing and actually maintain and improve the Native Prairie habitat, and that's what we have learned since 1980. So this proposal would essentially allow grazed lands to be included in the prairie tax exemption if the grazing was done in accordance with a plan approved by the DNR. That's the upshot of this part of the bill. There's currently about 443 landowners that are participating in this program. It affects about 18,000 acres in 45 counties. We estimate that if this change is made, we could add about 30,000 acres to the program. And we estimate that it would take until fiscal year 2010 to do this. And so the estimated fiscal impact of the general fund, which wouldn't fully occur until fiscal year 2010, is $60,000. And this is the equalized portion of the school levy, which is estimated at 40% of the total. So we based it on an average tax rate of $5 per acre on the 30,000 acres that we are estimating would be enrolled in the program. So that's the explanation of the first part of the bill. The second part of the bill has to do with conservation easements that are acquired by the DNR on Native Prairie as part of what's referred to as the Native Prairie Bank Program. And this was a program that began in 1987, and to date the DNR has purchased 69 easements on about 5,300 acres of land. And most of the land that's acquired under this program is Native Prairie, so it qualifies for the prairie tax exemption, and therefore the property tax rate of the land isn't really an issue. But some portions of some of the land that we acquire easements on isn't Native Prairie. It's old fields that were cropped or land that was at one time put under the plow. And it's included in the acquisition in order to provide a buffer for the Native Prairie habitat and to round out the boundaries of the acquisition. And this land is generally taxed at the agricultural tax rate prior to the acquisition of the easement. And what we've heard from some landowners and some county tax assessors is that according to a strict interpretation of the law, this land could go to a tax classification of recreational, seasonal rather than agricultural, and that would raise the tax rate. So we're concerned in discussions with landowners about acquiring these easements if they ask that question that we'd have to tell them that we're not sure what will happen to the tax rate. So the proposal is just to clarify that land acquired as a Native Prairie Bank easement would continue to be taxed at the agricultural rate. And this is consistent with the way that other conservation easements are taxed under programs like Reinvest in Minnesota and the Conservation Reserve Program. So that we don't, the only thing, other thing I should add is we don't really anticipate a fiscal impact with this part of the bill because we're pretty sure that most or all the land that's been acquired thus far that falls into this category is still at the agricultural tax rate. So that, I think, is all the explanation that I have, and then I could answer questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hirsch. Representative Magnus, is this bill in taxes then?
Yeah,
there it is.
Going to taxes, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick comment. I've got a few acres of land that I've planted into Native Prairie grass and found it to be a really, really interesting little ecosystem of the different types of plants that are in there and the different creatures that are also in there. And I thought, you know, one of the things that I became aware of is that, you know, it doesn't hurt to take the hay off of it once in a while, and it, in fact, is good to burn it off. And I thought maybe you could just comment on that very briefly, because I would not anticipate that the grazing, if it's done right, is really going to hurt it at all.
Mr. Hurd,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Newman, that's an excellent point. In its original state, you know, Native Prairie was renewed by fire, and of course we don't allow that to happen very much anymore except under tightly controlled prescribed burns. But it's a very good point, because the haying or the grazing, if it's done correctly, can mimic some of the characteristics of fire that gives that period of renewal. It's not exactly like it, but it's similar enough that it does have some benefits. That's a very good point.
I just have another question too. Is any of the proposed land coming in rotational grazing type of dairy operation type things? Is that in the purview of this, or do you know? Anybody? Representative Magnus, you know?
It's possible, Mr. Chairman, because one of the things that we're trying to do with this also is to maintain grazing lands for the livestock out there. My cattlemen and dairy folks are really struggling trying to find pasture land, and this, I think, allows two things to happen. It allows the Native Prairie Bank to continue and Native Prairie lands to continue with, but also it does allow grazing so we can support that industry too.
Yeah, it just made me think about it. I've got couple of my constituents that do the rotational grazing model, and they're very concerned. Representative Newman, you brought up the issue, and I thought about that. They're very concerned and about maintaining the health of their pastures, and that would probably lend itself to this. So, any other questions? Representative Magnus, thank you. Mr. Hirsch, thank you for coming.
Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Representative Erickson, should we take your bill? Okay, members, we're going to switch to Representative Erickson's bill. This is House File 3326.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3326, the first engrossment, to be considered for inclusion in the K-12 finance omnibus bill. Mr. Chair and members, many of you have heard this bill before. This is another tool for teachers seeking additional licensure. It is a directive to the Board of Teaching to create a license for teachers seeking additional licensures in areas which the superintendent, or in an area in which the superintendent has made recommendations. So the difference between this and the original bill is now there's a requirement that the superintendent recommends that this teacher have an additional license. There are other changes from the original as it was introduced. Now the teacher must receive the license only in the grade levels at which he or she was originally licensed, unless the district superintendent has made a request that this license extend into another teaching level. So I think what we heard from the superintendent from Sleepy Eye was that sometimes he has a secondary teacher who wishes to move into an elementary area and sees the potential there and wanted that kind of flexibility, and we allowed for that. If you're looking at the language in the bill, you will also notice that a change from the original language is that this now refers to a secondary vocational license based on degree requirements in not only home ec, industrial education, but ag education too, because we heard from the ag educators and they asked that we include them, business education and marketing education. This, of course, is all premised on passage of the Praxis 2 exam, which is the content test for this specific area. This bill is supported by charter schools, the alternative learning centers, MREA, the ag educators, and, you know, I have heard from more teachers on this bill and the science bill than ever before. So whether it's a teacher in Edina whose assignments have changed and she's on a waiver or a variance, or I've heard from a teacher in Rosemont, and these are just a few from whom I've heard, but I'm trying to scope the Twin Cities and the rural area, New Ulm, Cocado, and Cloquet. I have received emails from all of those just urging me to try to get this enacted into law. These are experienced teachers. They write very articulate emails to me, so I know they are the best of the best, and we want to offer this option for them. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions, and I'm sure we have someone who would like to oppose it.
Ms. Halswager, would you like to come up and testify at this point? Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Halswager, Education Minnesota. I guess maybe I should ask, how many more licensing bills are we going to do? And we have, there are five licensing bills up. They're in multiple places, and I basically come here and I say the same thing over and over. But I would encourage you not to support this bill. As I just said when I came down before, teaching is more than taking a test, and this, what I heard on the radio, I've got to get that information and get it to you about how we teach science is important. You need to know that the Science Teachers Organization is opposed to a similar provision where even having a life science license and having the opportunity to take the Praxis 2 in, let's say, chemistry or physics, they are opposed to it. Science teachers are opposed to even in the science area. So I'm sure science teachers would be opposed to this, and that's their professional organization. Teaching, as I said, is more than taking a test, and we strongly oppose this bill. I would just also point out to you, do we think that superintendents have the ability to distinguish if someone is able to teach a different grade level or a different grade level, whether it's high school or elementary? I would propose that they might know who works well with kids in various levels, but that doesn't mean that they have the experience or the knowledge or the pedagogy to do that. So we would encourage you not to support this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Allsberg, I've got a quick question. Would you be concerned that school administrators would put teachers in a tough position by saying they should go teach and take this test when they really would not rather not? Or are you concerned about teachers jumping at this and doing it when maybe they shouldn't be doing it? Which of the two would you be most concerned about in terms of, because obviously if an administrator and a teacher decide that, or an administrator and a board and a teacher decide together that they want to pursue this and have that person teaching rather than a variance or whatever, that's a two-way street there in terms of determining that's the right thing. And so that's on.
Mr. Chair, it's a very good question. I think both of them are very problematic, and I really can't distinguish between the two, but I'll give you a real-life story. When I was a field staff person working with a very large school district, a teacher who was in trouble because their evaluations were poor said, I think I'm going to lose my job. And I asked the situation, what's the deal? What's happening? And he said that this principal had told him that he had to teach in an area in which he was not licensed, which you are not supposed to do. And I don't know exactly how they got around it and what kinds of waivers or variances they may have received from the Board of Teaching. But this teacher was teaching, I believe, math, and he was a licensed science teacher. And he maybe could have passed the Praxis 2 test in math. I know he didn't take it. But this teacher was losing his job because he did not have the skills to teach math. He may have understood math, but he did not have the skills to do it. Why did this teacher take this? Because he knew he wasn't going to have a job otherwise. Sometimes people make decisions to save their job, but it might not be the best for the kids. In the meantime, this teacher did not do a good job teaching these kids, and these kids were exposed to and taught by a teacher who wasn't qualified to teach. I don't want my own children to be with a teacher who's not qualified. I don't think Minnesotans want teachers teaching their kids who are not qualified. When we poll the public, this is one of the issues that Minnesotans are most concerned about, having a qualified teacher in the content area and having the skills necessary to teach the kids. This issue is almost more important to them than anything else. The numbers go through the roof. Just because someone has a piece of paper on their wall that says they're licensed doesn't necessarily make them qualified if we are lowering the standards for teaching, and that is what you are doing with this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Demmer and committee. And I hope that when Ms. Allsweiler was field staff, she counseled that person out of teaching because that was her job, and I hope that she did that. Just a statement about superintendents. Most of my conversations with them are about ways to get the teachers who are incompetent out of the classroom. And I would say that many of us on this committee have had conversations with our superintendents looking for ways in which he or she can dismiss a teacher without having to go through all of the ramifications that occur. So I do have faith in superintendents today. I know they agree with parents that they want the best of the best teaching their children. So with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 3326 be considered for inclusion in the K-12 Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Okay, so next we'll do my bill. Representative Erickson, would you like to come up here?
Welcome to the testifying table, Vice Chair Denmark. Nice to have you there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 3411 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus K-12 bill.
Go ahead, Vice Chair Dimmer. Present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3411 is, members, at the face of it, what it is, we're bringing back a program that we used to have that would give the state of Minnesota an opportunity to invest in our teaching staff statewide. What it is, it brings to mind, there was a book that a lot of us are aware of, I think by Lou Gerstner, called Nation at Risk, and he talked about a highly qualified and professional teaching staff. And I think as we in the state of Minnesota look at investing in things with increased excellence, I talked about the world-class education that we are trying to aspire to. One of the challenges we have in education as well as other places is to keep our best and the brightest, keep them challenged, and keep them challenging themselves to be better and better for the benefit of kids. I think that in looking at this particular program, the National Board Certification appears to me to be a very rigorous. I'm not a teacher and I haven't done this, but from the reading I've done and from what I've seen from statistics, it's a very rigorous, a very difficult endeavor for teachers to partake in and to gain. Less than half the teachers that even become accepted to apply for certification become certified, and it's a process of investment for them, both in terms of time and in terms of dollars. And what this bill does is basically help with reimbursement for that and give some incentive to help move those things through. We use reimbursement such as this in the private sector all the time to try to incent excellence and moving forward with the knowledge and the skills that we have. So, Madam Chair and members, with that, I'm going to turn it over to a couple of National Board Certified Teachers, to tell them about their experience and to give from their perspective.
Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin to explain to us your experience as a nationally certified teacher.
My name is Lynette Wayne, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm a National Board Certified Teacher from Hastings, and I currently teach first grade there. And I'm here to share my enthusiasm for National Board, and I'd also like to thank Representative Demmer for supporting our efforts. We strongly believe that this proposed legislation will promote the highest standards of teaching in our state, which turns out to be good for both Minnesota students and schools. National Board certification is a very rigorous process. Only 40 to 50% of the candidates attain it their first year, and if they try, their success rate is about 65% for their second or third try. They have 3 years to attain it. That in itself speaks to the rigor of the program. Currently, there are 47,000 National Board Certified Teachers in Minnesota, in the nation, and in Minnesota we have 276. One of the reasons that we're proposing getting some of our incentives back that we used to have is because our neighboring states of Wisconsin and Iowa have state incentives, and they're growing their National Board Certified Teachers quite rapidly. I believe our request is modest in comparison to theirs, but it will significantly help to support the teachers who want to pursue this. And when teachers talk to me about National Board certification, it's often the cost of applying and the lack of support that keeps them from becoming candidates. I find no greater joy than teaching in the first grade classroom with energetic and enthusiastic first grade students. Going through this difficult and challenging process really made me critically examine what I do in the classroom and the impact that it has on my students. It requires me to think deeply about my practice so I can better understand what I do well and where I need to improve. It's very much performance-based and required me to submit value-added data about my students. It was personally the most challenging yet rewarding process that I've ever gone through in my 27 years of teaching. Simply put, National Board certification is about accomplished teaching. We know research has consistently linked quality teaching to the achievement of our students, and sometimes that's hard to define, but now there are research studies that show that National Board certified teachers are advancing student learning as well as offering professional growth for teachers. In your packet, if you haven't had a chance, there is a yellow sheet that talks about some of the research that has come through now. National Board is supported by teachers, administrators, school board members, parents, and businesses. And especially for administrators, it can positively impact recruitment and retention of teachers. It requires teachers to demonstrate their practice in the classroom, and it can elevate teaching in a way that can inspire and excite the school community. And for parents, it places the emphasis on student learning. It values collaboration with families as an important way to enhance student learning. So National Board Certification is an investment in our schools and our students and our communities. Again, this is about accomplished teaching, and I thank you for your support for this.
Thanks very much, Ms. Wayne, and thank you for teaching first graders.
Thank you.
Welcome, and please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Mary Catherine Ricker, and I'm a National Board Certified Teacher in Early Adolescent English Language Arts. I have taught 7th and 8th grade English in St. Cloud, Minnesota, Washington State, Seoul, South Korea, and currently in St. Paul Public Schools. And I am now the new president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers. And I want to thank you very much for your attention to this opportunity to advance the National Board Certification process across the state of Minnesota. I went through the process to earn my National Board Certification based on a volunteer meeting I attended that was coordinated by Lynette Wayne, and that was the first opportunity I had to meet her. And I have to say, her enthusiasm, her commitment, and her drive to improve the access to, support for, and recognition of National Board Certified teachers throughout Minnesota has resulted in more and more of us advocating for this increased professionalism. In my new position as president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers, I am absolutely committed to teacher quality and more opportunities to demonstrate our professionalism. In supporting this bill, I've asked principals in my district what they need to encourage their teachers to attain their National Board certification, and they responded support, and they gave me exact examples of what sort of support they needed at a school level, or if they could have a place to send teachers for that support, they would be extremely grateful. Also, anecdotally, in St. Paul Public Schools, when there was a formal support program, St. Paul Public Schools had dozens of teachers earning their National Board certification every year. Now that there is no formal support program, we have 1 to 2 teachers a year. And so, and teachers have mentioned again and again that they do need that support. This is an excellent opportunity to send a statewide message that Minnesota cares about teacher quality and insists on developing and recognizes those teachers in every part of our state, not just St. Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ricker, and thank you for teaching our students. Are there questions for the witnesses? Ms. Wayne, I have a question. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Bernardi. No, go ahead, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to tell Representative Demmer and our testifiers how refreshing it is to have a proposal here that's trying to raise the bar even higher for our highly qualified teachers here in Minnesota. And if you have any anecdotal, one simple story about a student achievement that, help the student sail beyond what they would have done otherwise if a certified teacher had not been a part of that student's life. Do you have any very short story?
Ms. Richard.
Thank you. Just this past year, we had an ELL teacher in St. Paul who earned his National Board certification. He found out in November. And so I contacted him to congratulate him, and then I asked him what the process did for him. And he talked about how the professional program he went through to license him as an ELL teacher certainly went, it certainly helped him cover the basics and to hit the ground running. But going through his National Board program really helped him focus on individual students, and that while his licensing program really helped talk to him about teaching a classroom, he felt his National Board certification process really helped focus him on meeting the individual needs of students, and that how that is obviously a very academic part of his licensing program, but that it wasn't the focus of his academic licensing program the way it was for the National Board program. And I would have to say the same thing. And one of the things I had heard from National Board teachers while I was going through the process and while I was reading through some National Board materials, they said one of the most helpful things is to even just have a note taped in various parts of your room just saying, what am I doing for all of my students today? And that constant reflection on what you're doing for all of your students is what drives you to really make some of the gains that National Board teachers are being shown to make. And it's that constant reflection that we don't get the opportunity to be taught in our traditional licensing programs that the National Board certification program really focuses on.
Thank you. I have a question for either of you teachers or both. Mm-hmm. What if a teacher earns his or her license through an alternative pathway, either at a college or in the proposal that I have before the legislature? Would you still support this bill if they had earned their license through a pathway other than perhaps the way you earned your licensure?
Hold on, I have a question. Myself.
Madam Chair, if I could mention, I think what we're looking at is there are qualifications before you can apply for help through this program, and I think they're looking to see if there would be anything mutually exclusive about the question. And so anyway, mm-hmm. Do you have a...
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there are, but Ms. Wayne?
To be a candidate for National Board, it says that you have to be a licensed teacher employed in a Minnesota public school.
Correct.
So I think that's what the certification asks for in that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then the National Board certification. Oh, thank you. The National Board certification, the National Board of Professional Teaching Practices, they have their set of requirements that we both had to go through in order to even qualify for the process. And so I was looking to see if I had that material, and I don't, because I would like to make sure that they need to recognize a licensed program as well, and you have to have a certain number of years of teaching, at least three. And so I would want to make sure I didn't speak out of turn for what the National Board actually requires to even be entered into the program.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Demmer. Would you like to move your bill again?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd renew my motion for House File 3411 to be included for possible, to be laid over for possible inclusion. And just as a final comment, I think the passion that I've felt from teachers that have contacted me, I've had some emails since I brought this up, but the passion I've felt for teaching and enhancing their profession, these are the folks we want teaching our kids, and if we can invest and give them some incentive, I think this is the type of thing we should be doing. And also, I should mention, in the interest of time, Ms. Elswiger from Education Minnesota did not testify today, but she did testify on the other committee, and they strongly support this also. Mm-hmm. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Demmer and ladies for coming today. Welcome to the testifying table, Representative Fiskins, our last bill on the calendar for today. House File 1229, do you want your testifiers present? Yes?
Madam Chair, if I could, please.
Yes. Well, the testifiers for House File 1229, elections provided to determine whether to detach land from an existing school district or a new independent school district, please come forth and join Representative Fiskins. Representative Biskins, would you like to move your bill, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to have House File 1229 before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus education bill.
Representative Biskins moves House File 1229 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Present your bill, please, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of this committee, House File 1229 is before this committee as a reform policy item in the state of Minnesota. Members, Madam Chair, if you've ever had a chance to look at the configuration of school districts throughout the state of Minnesota, you will see some interesting at best lines. The best of jigsaw puzzle artists in the world couldn't have put together pieces that would be like this. The history of a lot of these lines simply came from asking farmers what school district you want to belong to. And the line was then drawn on the farmer's property line. While that is, it served its purpose at the time, Madam Chair, members, I don't think that the drawing of school districts has been as responsive as could potentially be as we continue to grow and develop as a state. And so now we're faced with situations where a student, because he lives in school district X, must be bused 10, 15, 20 miles to their public high school when 3 miles in the other direction sits another public high school. Right? But they don't live in that school district, nor do their parents pay property taxes to support said school district. You also have a situation that is in the heart of my legislative district, Madam Chair, where we have a community that is upwards over 22,000 people and actually belongs to 4 different school districts. The city of Savage is broken up by the Shakopee, Prior Lake, Burnsville, and Bloomington school districts. Madam Chair and members, there's a lot of research that's been done recently on the importance of size when it comes to schools and when it comes to school districts. So much research and so convincing research that one of the wealthiest men in the world, Bill Gates, has initiated, Bill and Melinda Gates have initiated tremendous amount of funding for small schools, small school development, because the research is showing that these types of schools and school districts are actually better for children. Madam Chair, members of this community, in state, or this committee, in state statute, we have laws which would allow school districts to cooperate. We have laws which would allow school districts to consolidate. We even have laws on the books which would allow a part of a school district to detach from its current district and attach to a contiguous school district. What we don't have, though, Madam Chair and members, is a law for a parcel of land to detach from its current school district and become its own school district. And I think that's a hole that we should fill. Madam Chair, members, a bill similar to this was heard in education policy and reform. A lot of discussion. I think there was a lot of interest shown for that piece of legislation. However, the legislation did not move forward, and some of the concern that members supported during that testimony, during that hearing, centered around number one, piece of legislation that was very specific to one school district. That gave some people concern. If we're going to do this, let's look at a broad-based statewide policy. This bill creates a broad-based statewide policy. Another concern that was expressed quite a few times in the policy committee was the concern that the school board itself wasn't an integral part of this decision. Madam Chair and members, if you look on page 1, lines 11 and 12, all right, it is the school board that has the authority to move forward with the ballot question. Right? So this puts this in the hands of the school board itself. And so those are a few differences that from this piece of legislation and the one that those who sit on policy committee may have seen in there. Madam Chair, members, for the purview of this committee, this bill does have a $99,000 fiscal note. The department estimates that it would be it would take the equivalent of one full-time person if this bill would move forward. I would recommend, if anyone in this earshot of my voice right now is looking for a job, this might be one to snap up on. You know, as we look at the level that has to be reached, you know, this person may be slightly less busy than a Maytag repairman, right? But the fiscal note as it is, that's the bill before you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have two people who'd like to testify in support of this bill, and if it be your pleasure, I'd ask that they be given that opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Distance. Let's begin with the gentleman from Savage. Welcome to the testifying table. State your name for the record and begin to tell us your story.
David Neville. I live in Savage, Minnesota. I also own Newtown Solutions. We provide engineering and high-tech talent to Minnesota companies, so you can understand the importance of helping education move forward. The more I get involved in the educational issues in not only my community but around the state, we have realized that there's a lot of grassroots energy in our state and our individual communities for their school districts. And it's unfortunate that right now we're not allowed to really bring this energy to the table and as either industry and the private commercial government sector to work with communities as well as they could. This bill would give us a tool for those communities to analyze their current situation. I think you'd see some communities take up the option to move to a new district. I think you'd see a lot of communities who've thought about it once it's analyzed would probably be happy with where they're at and move in a different direction at that point. This bill is very important to just basically give our communities the tools they need to plan for their growth. There is a lot of fear-mongering that you hear throughout the rank and file about some of the problems this will cause. It really comes back down to if you don't give them the tools, if we can't make the analysis and make the decisions on how best to move our communities forward in education, you still deal with some of the same problems over and over. I do live in Savage. There is several school districts. One of the school districts in our city has no kids from our city that go there. That's how bizarre this current situation is. We are looking for support for this one, so the analysis can be done, future planning. There's just an immense amount of growth going on in our city and the surrounding communities. And we're basically, if you don't know where Savage is, it's south of the river, and we're kind of an outer tier suburb. And we're in one of these, you know, we have several huge school districts that represent us. There's nobody really representing just Savage. We ourselves would like to look at the option of forming our own school district. We have a big city. We have the resources. We have the buildings. We just want an opportunity to legally look at this, analyze it, and see if it doesn't move forward and make sense for our community. We are finding throughout the state that there are, you know, at least a half dozen examples I'm aware of people actively wanting to look at this option. Whether or not that's what happens in the future, forming a new district will be something totally different. Senator Kelly came and talked to a group with the MHTA about 2 weeks ago with the ACE Leadership Program. This is a group of about 25 executives, and this bill was brought up and he discussed it. I was amazed at the three or four examples he gave of why a bill like this needs to be on the books. I didn't get the impression he was real supportive of it, but I thought his examples of what this would do for different communities was really important. And it was really basically giving the representation to the right group of people to make the decisions on their community educational needs. I can tell you from a corporate standpoint, It's a lot easier to address one community and get them on board with a new initiative or a program or a project to be done in that district and that school versus trying to go to three separate communities, sell them on the same issue, get all three to vote on one. Having one person vote on something is pretty definitive. Having three people vote on it, there just tends to be a little more dissension than the groups would like. This could help eliminate some of that. I think help not only with the boundary issues, but really build more community support, which I would hope will foster more corporate support for our school systems moving forward. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Neville. Ms. Post from Elk River, former school board member, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Say your name for the record.
My name
begin
is
your
Kathleen.
Testimony.
Excuse me. My name is Kathleen Post, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for allowing me this opportunity to speak. I wish to speak in support of House File 1229. Education Minnesota is running political commercials stating that we cannot allow mediocrity in education. They imply that more money will solve that problem. I believe that the real way to avoid mediocrity in our system is to engage students, parents, and the community in our educational system. To do that, we need manageable and locally controlled school districts. For the most part, the school districts were laid out 50 years ago. They follow illogical borders based on the preference of landowners at the time. I did not confer with Representative Biskin on this information, by the way. We have school districts such as Buffalo and felt he was taking my speech away. we have school districts such as Buffalo School District that have areas of another school district completely surrounding it. They have an island within the Rockford School District. The Rockford School District has an island within the Buffalo School District. The districts are now considered the districts that are now considered the metro area were at the time so far out many people believed that they needed to make arrangements to stay overnight. The cities have names like St. Michael, Savage, Rogers, Delano, Big Lake, Jordan, Belle Plaine, and Stillwater. Today these residents commute to work from these very same places. To create the large geographic school districts we have today, the state lumps cities together. I don't know why. Today, these are the fastest growing areas in the state of Minnesota. Populations are increasing, schools are overcrowded. We have lost our sense of involvement and a community. We constantly hear, we need to lower class sizes. That is not, I repeat, a possibility. If we cannot build new facilities because bonding bills in these large geographic areas run between $100 and $250 million just for the buildings, and that does not include operating levies. Talk is cheap when it comes to lowering class sizes. Buildings are expensive. It is almost financially impossible to build three elementaries, a middle school, and a high school that the large geographic school districts require and that have to be built all at the same time on the same bond. Young families in our senior population cannot afford those taxes. We need to identify where we live and who our neighbors are. We need to have a sense of community, especially with our schools. We need to be involved as parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, residents, and business leaders. We need the sense of community and partnerships this bill will give us. We can bring decisions about our schools back into our communities. We can build the buildings we need for a smaller geographic area. We can lower the cost of the bond and maybe, just maybe, reach that dream of smaller class sizes. I support this bill because it does allow for the local residents to direct their time and energy and much-needed involvement in their local communities and their schools. This can do only one thing, and that is to positively affect the education of the next generation of our children, our main goal as parents, residents, and business leaders within our community. Let's put a stop to the talk about the mediocrity and act upon it. In the name of our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Poet. Are there questions for the witnesses? Is there anyone in the audience who opposes this bill? Please come forward.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Deans. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Deans, and I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Madam Chair, we testified on this bill when it was in at policy, so I'll try to keep my testimony relatively brief. And I'll try to keep it, some of it to issues that are actually before this committee. This sets up an election process. A board could call this election on its own motion. However, if you get a petition signed by at least 50 electors, which isn't a hard petition to get, then you'd have to have this election. When we do consolidations, when we do the other kinds of organizational efforts that are laid out in the statutes that Representative Biskins went through, there's a plat and there's a plan that's developed, and it goes to the state and that's reviewed. There isn't any review here. It's just the deal is set up and it goes to the voters. Now, whether that's good or bad, I guess you can argue, but there isn't anyone looking at the educational efficiency of this. The thing comes in with a petition from 50 voters, and that's the way that system's going to be set up. If the program is approved, if this question is approved, all the property would remain subject to the old debt. That's constitutionally required. If there was a new district that was created, that would be subject to its own debt. Let me suggest that one or both of these districts are going to be short something. In many school districts in this state, we don't have two high schools. You have one high school. In lots of those places, if that's split, you're in the newly created school district, there isn't going to be a high school, or there isn't going to be one in the old district because it went with the new district. One of the two. In either case, both districts are probably going to have capital needs that they're going to have to go to the voters to address. Moreover, this bill has a provision. And you'll recall some of this when we talked about the Elk River bill, for those of you that were there. But what happens is the commissioner has to determine what the value of the assets that are in the one district are and what the value of the assets in the other district are. And the old district basically needs to pay that difference as a claim. And that's levied in 1 year, 1 to 3 years as a judgment levy. So if you had, I'm going to use hypothetical figures here. You just heard some figures from the Elk River board member talking about $250 million bond issues and that. But let me just use an easier example. If we had $150 million that was left in one district, and you went over and here's the newly created district and it's got an elementary school in it. So that's maybe $30 million. That means you'd have a $120 million claim, or maybe half of that. One of those two numbers would be the claim. That would be levied under the judgment levy in 1 to 3 years. Members, we're talking a huge property tax increase on those people. Some people conceivably could be taxed out of their homes. I don't know how big that number is. I understand that the people have to pass this. But you know, you're just liable to get one of these passed where people don't understand quite how that number is. That number won't be determined until after the election is held. Because at that point, the commissioner goes out, and as you saw, if you read the fiscal note, they do an analysis of what the difference is between those two, and then that gets levied after the fact. That can be a huge number. Now, I don't know whether any of these will pass, but I know that I've dealt with this committee for a number of years, and I've seen where we've made some changes in equalization formulas. around here for referendum levies. And because of that, you're required to carry a higher levy number based on the assumption that more of these will pass. Well, in this case, you're going to have to carry something based on the assumption that maybe one of these might pass for this next biennium. And I don't know whether that's Elk River or Osseo or Anoka or Prior Lake or Burnsville or Rosemont or whatever it is. But if it's one of those big districts, I think you've got to carry a $100 million debt number in this committee based on your accounting system, not based on mine. I've argued lots of times you don't have to carry that. It's kind of, it's not a big deal. It probably won't happen. And every time I've been told by the chairs and by committee staff that isn't the way we do it. We have to carry a number. I understand in the fiscal note the department says we don't have any idea what that number would be. Well, I don't have any idea what that number would be either, because I don't know whether any of these will pass. But if you set the system up, that's the way the system has to work. The just a couple more quick things. Just so that you know, because part of this is, you know, you need to understand what how this would work too. If you did get one of these approved, the way that the division of the employees works, let's take the teachers for instance. You figure out how many kids went to the one district and how many kids are left in the other. And then it just, the commissioner has a list, and by seniority, teacher, top teacher A goes here, teacher B goes here, teacher C goes here, teacher D goes there. That's by operation of the current statute. That's the system that's in here. I don't know whether that's a great system. Also, if in the consolidation laws, in the cooperation and combination laws, things, you have incentives that are set up because you understand that there are startup costs and whatever in these districts. Some, one of these places is going to have to hire a whole new set of administrators and a new central office and a new whatever. Somebody's going to have to buy new uniforms, whichever district it is, whether the Lakers uniforms stay with the one district or go to the other district, I don't know, but somebody's got to buy that stuff. In some of your other types of situations, you have those types of startup costs addressed. There is no provision in this bill that's addressed. One final point. We think that in... I understand there's a lot of people that we've heard from today that are have some particular theory here in mind. But, you know, these things tend to have a different impact in different places than the one that we expect here or the people that we hear from. We had a whole series of consolidations in the 50s. And there's still some people at one end of that school district that don't particularly like the people in the other end of that school district or don't feel that they're getting their way. And we think that this is going to perhaps give them another weapon to at least threaten, we're going to do this unless, you know, we get our way. I guess all that does is trigger the election, but, you know, these things aren't cheap to do, and they're not cheap to run, and it does create additional problems out there, and we're not certain whether that will work correctly. And also, it's not clear if you do this division and there's not a high school in each district, that district is not subject to mandatory dissolution immediately upon its creation. Because the present statutes say if you don't have a K-12 system that you're running in each of that school district is subject to mandatory dissolution and attachment to another district.
Thank you, Mr. Deans. Are there questions of Mr. Deans or...
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think Mr. Dean's talked longer than three of my presentations in a row, and I appreciate having the opportunity to address the issues that he mentioned. First off, I'm not a lawyer, but I'll sit down with Representative Meslow, and I know Mr. Dean's is a smart man, and so I'm wondering, you know, in lawyerese, maybe words don't mean things, but as I read line 12 of page 1, it says the school board of an independent school district may, on its own motion or on a petition signed by at least the entire impetus is left to the school board. And I think Mr. Dean started with his premise of his long dissertation based on a false premise, and I'll have to see where Mr. Dean's is coming up with the rationale that he used. Number one, this is a decision made by the local school board. Number two, it's nice that we might want to care because people outside of St. Paul aren't as bright as we are sitting here in St. Paul, and we want to care for them and protect and nurture them. Members, I would contend that the people who are moving forward on this issue would take the time to look at what the property tax implications are, would take the time to look at what the facilities implications are, would take the time to look at what the staffing and the need to hire and maybe not new staff are and what those implications might be. We've got intelligent people who live in the state of Minnesota. I think we should give them just a wee bit of credit, and maybe more than Mr. Deans probably has here. Final thing I'll mention, members of this committee, is that, you know, I don't know what we would be afraid of. Right? I don't know why we would be afraid to allow the good people who live in community X, Y, or Z to make these kind of decisions. Right? You know, we talked about, well, there's going to be winners and losers, and small school districts may or may not be more efficient. Representative Bernardi's gone, but her, I, and Representative Greiling did a little note-taking just the other day when we had a list of school district fund balances. And, you know, there's 198 school districts with fund balances, of general fund balances of greater than 15%. 196 of those are small rural school districts. I think maybe we have funding mechanisms in place to help school districts that are small. It seems to be me that there's a reason why they have good fund balances. Who knows? Maybe somebody has turned to Chapter 2 in their economics book, you know, the one that comes right after the chapter on economies of scale, which is all about diseconomies of scale. All right? Members, I would appreciate your support, and Madam Chair, I ask, thank you for the opportunity.
Representative Biskins renews his motion that House File 1229 be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Biskins. Representative Meslow, have you read the minutes and studied those so that we can approve those or correct them and then approve them?
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes and I would move them at this time.
Representative Meslow moves the minutes. All those, either any corrections or additions, excuse me. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved for April 4th. Announcements, the next meeting, I don't see the chairs. Oh, yes, Mr. Vice Chair, when's the next meeting?
Tomorrow
at 12:30 in this room. Yes, thank you very much. With that, this meeting is adjourned.